You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. You know, I wanted to talk about creating pollinator gardens on the show today, and I found a great guest who literally wrote the book. With us is Jarrett Daniels. He is a professional nature photographer. He's an author, native plant enthusiast, and entomologist. He currently serves as curator and director of Lepidoptera at the Florida Museum of Natural History, and he's an associate professor of entomology at the University of Florida. Now, he's the author of the book, Native Plant Gardening for Birds, Bees, and Butterflies Upper Midwest. So what questions do you have about luring those pollinators to your landscape? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or of course, you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Jarrett, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jill. Really looking forward to it.
You know, I was like, what does a Florida guy know about pollinators in the Midwest? But you told me you're actually from Wisconsin.
I am. I grew up in a small town in southeast Wisconsin in Caledonia, and I had great parents. They had about 8 acres of property. And so really the natural world was my backyard as a kid. And that kind of set me on a path that I can make a career out of what I do, and I just really love dealing with everything, birds, bees, insects, native plants.
You are a very lucky person to be doing what you love.
I do, yes, I'm very lucky, yes.
So why did you decide to write, you wrote a series of these books for different areas of the United States. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, I started out writing actually field guides. So I have a number of field guides for butterflies and other insects. And, you know, I'm a entomologist by training. I work here at the Florida Museum and University of Florida. But one of my real passions is really getting people interested in the natural world. And so this is a really great way of doing that, of sharing, you know, knowledge and just getting people excited about what they can do in their home landscape, whether it's large, small, because, you know, more and more landscapes are eaten up by development. And, you know, in your own backyard, this is where we can all make a difference. We can create habitat and resources and really get families, individuals, kids excited about the natural world. And, you know, I have a strong passion for that overall. And so I'm very fortunate to have a fantastic publisher. And I really just enjoy writing books and, you know, taking photographs and, you know, just getting other people excited.
Now, this book's been out there for a while. Has it done pretty well for you?
I think so, yeah. I think the whole series has done really well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an increasingly popular topic, right? Pollinator gardening, and people are realizing that it's not just about attracting these organisms. It's the other benefits, too. It's, you know, planting native plants that help reduce water input and fertilizer and chemical inputs into your yard, making your yard more attractive to your neighbors and that curb appeal. So it's not just about, you know, nature enthusiasts, it's about something good for your wallet, good for the broader environment, and all those kind of win-wins just make it a great opportunity for people to get involved.
And I know on this show in the last 10 years or so, it's really ramped up with the amount of people that are so interested in bringing in the pollinators for so many different wonderful reasons, and the native plants in particular, which we've been talking about for a long time, because I don't know if you're familiar with Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery, but he's been with us for forever, it seems like. And yeah, every year it just gets more and more popular. So I think there's a lot of people that are joining the bandwagon with you. So yeah, for sure. And now this book, I haven't gotten a chance to look at it completely, but I have a chance to look at the index, and it looks like there's pretty much everything you need to know about adding pollinators to your garden, and from scratch or from just, you know, adding one more bush or just a little bit of a habitat for pollinators. So before we get to that, we do have a caller, Tom and Nina, who has something for you. So let's go to him first. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, my question centers around the use of neonicotinoid chemicals in the nursery industry. I've tried to look at purchasing shrubs, flowering shrubs for my backyard, and I asked the owners of the nurseries, are there stock they're selling, have those been treated with neonicotinoid pesticides? And they can't give me an answer that assures me they haven't been at some point. So I'm concerned about the impact of that. And then also, where can I purchase shrubbery for my yard that won't be treated with that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You know, the increased use of many different pesticides, you know, do end up obviously in the foliage of plants and can also occur in the nectar and pollen of plants, which, you know, is a kind of a double threat to, you know, butterflies, bees, other pollinating insects. So trying to find pesticide-free plant material can be challenging, and neonicotinoids are particularly challenging class of pesticides because they are not only lethal to a lot of insects, but they can create other sublethal effects that affect the insect brain and navigation and bees and, you know, lots of downstream effects. So my best advice really is to reach out to native plant nurseries in Wisconsin. You know, Prairie Nursery, as you mentioned, is a great source, and just, you know, ask them if those plants have been treated. If they don't know, I would assume potentially that they are, and you might want to continue digging and trying to find another source. All these chemicals, however, do have a longevity period in those plants. They will eventually leach out of that plant material. So you plant it, you know, over time, it'll become more and more usable by pollinators, but there is a risk, you know, after initial purchase, if you know those plants have been treated.
Okay, thank you so much for the question, Tom. We appreciate that. So what are some of the pollinators that we want to attract? I mean, we have the overall bees, pollen, butterflies, and birds, but can we get a little more specific with some of them?
Sure. So, you know, butterflies are obviously probably the most charismatic group of pollinators that people want to invite into their landscape because they're harmless to humans. They're large, they're attractive, you know, they just come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes. And but beyond butterflies, you know, bees are probably the most efficient pollinators because they're going to flowers not only for a nectar reward but also to collect the pollen, and they use that to you know, feed to their developing brood back in their nest. So they're really efficient at moving pollen around the landscape. And, you know, whether it's crop species in Wisconsin or your tomatoes or other vegetables in your garden, you know, bees are great to have in that landscape to produce fruit and seeds and nuts. But there are a lot of other insects like moths, kind of the nocturnal realm of Lepidoptera that often go underappreciated in the landscape, but there are a huge diversity of moths. Many of these are crepuscular. They might come out at dawn and dusk and feed on a lot of longer tube blossoms in your landscape. Flies are a group of pollinators that people don't normally think of, but are incredibly diverse and serve, you know, not only as a pollinator, but different species of flies can also be natural pest control agents in your landscape. Beetles are pollinators. So, you know, many, many different insect groups can move pollen and, around the landscape. And we oftentimes focus maybe too much on bees and butterflies just because they're the most apparent.
Yeah, they tend to get all the attention because they're so cute.
But
indeed. Yeah, wasps, beetles, you know, things like that. We tend to say, let's get rid of those. But really, we need to be careful, don't we?
Indeed. And I think bees, you know, bees and wasps often get a little bit of a bad rap. I think most bees do because people are worried, obviously, about getting stung by a bee. But the vast majority of bees that we have in our landscape are native bees. These are generally solitary bees. So they're not, you know, protecting a large hive or nest. They lay their eggs and then they're gone. They don't provide any type of maternal care. So they're actually pretty docile and, you know, family friendly. Like, you know, you can have kids around native bees and generally you don't have to worry about them being aggressive or stinging you. So it's kind of a misconception that bees are aggressive and are out to sort of get you in the landscape.
Right. We've got another phone call from Bob in Sun Prairie. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know that bees and wasps and all that are pollinators, but we have a large flower garden and it's frequented by hummingbirds. And I'm wondering, are hummingbirds really also considered pollinators?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yes, they are. So, you know, beyond insects, there are a number of different, you know, animals that are pollinators, you know, bats, especially in the desert Southwest and in the tropics. Many birds, including hummingbirds, you know, move pollen from blossom to blossom. So they are true pollinators, but many species like hummingbirds or groups like hummingbirds and butterflies, they're kind of more accidental pollinators because they're going to that flower for a food reward like nectar. And in that process, pollen rubs off on their feathers or on their wings. And as they move from blossom to blossom, they transfer that pollen, but it's sort of happenstance in the landscape.
Great. Well, so you're doing your part, Bob. Thank you for the call. I appreciate that. So let's talk a little bit about some of the basic flowers that you think are kind of essential to a good pollinator garden. Obviously natives, so let's kind of start there.
Yeah, so definitely, you know, I'm a native plant enthusiast. I think natives are wonderful for so many reasons. Many native plants also are larval host plants for the caterpillars of butterflies and moths as well. But I kind of make the recommendation to start with kind of a broad palette of plants. If you don't know exactly what you want to attract, you want to have a diversity of flower shape and flower color in your landscape, because again, pollinating insects come in a wide variety of different shapes, sizes, different behaviors. How they feed at the flower, you know, matters. Even like a large butterfly, let's say the iconic monarch butterfly, it physically needs to land on the blossom in order to feed. So it needs a large landing platform, something akin to, say, a purple coneflower that has a really stable base. Mm-hmm. So not so much tailoring for individual species, but trying to pick a selection of flowers that come in different sizes, shapes, and forms. So different inflorescences will attract different species. So kind of start with a general palette, and then my recommendation really is to spend some time in your landscape, maybe buy a field guide or go onto iNaturalist and kind of observe what comes into your yard. And then you can kind of tailor your landscape a little more appropriately for maybe the most common butterflies or bees that you see or other organisms. But that's a great place to start, and really try to plant also in groupings, because groupings of plants are generally more apparent to these visually searching organisms. And then just really sit back and enjoy your landscape and watch what comes in. And I think most people are going to be amazed at what they see, the diversity of different insects. And, you know, obviously hummingbirds are, you know, incredibly fun to watch in the landscape, too.
Right. Hummingbirds especially. I think we all get tickled about hummingbirds more than anything. And then there's a hummingbird moth, too, which looks a lot like a hummingbird. And a lot of people get that confused. Do they kind of like the same things?
They do generally. So, you know, hummingbirds are mostly attracted to bright colored flowers and longer tubular blossoms. Mm-hmm. So things like salvias or some of the morning glories are really good choices for those. But those hummingbird moths are a group of kind of crepuscular or nocturnal moth species called sphinx moths. And they have a very long proboscis, but they hover at a blossom much like a hummingbird. And they can come in a wide range of sizes, and they can easily be mistaken for a hummingbird and are quite entertaining to watch in your landscape. Some are day flying, some are evening flying, some are out after dark, but there's a good diversity of those little guys as well.
Definitely. I found that they're easier to take a picture of, too, for some reason. So they tend to hover a little bit longer than the hummingbirds do.
They do.
Yeah. We're talking to Jarrett Daniels. He is curator of the Lepidoptera at the Florida Museum of Natural History, and author of Native Plant Gardening for Birds and Bees and Butterflies, the Upper Midwest. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Next week, we're going to be talking with Diana Alfuth. She's going to be helping you with your gardening questions. But right now, we're talking about pollinator gardens. If you've got a question, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. And that address is talk@wpr.org. So let's get back to some of the ways to maybe bring in some of those bees, butterflies, moth, etc., Jarrett. If we're going to be just adding a few things to an existing garden, what are some of the things that you would suggest that are maybe the simplest things to do?
That's a great question. So I would start with a few really high quality pollinator attracting plants. And there are many, many, many out there that would be great. Things like purple coneflower, things like obviously milkweed for monarch butterflies, and really just, you know, adding a few elements to your landscape like that and kind of cluster plants together. So you have maybe three or five of those species of plants. So you have a little bit of a mass that's visually attractive to you and also more apparent to the pollinating insects that are kind of foraging around that landscape. And then you can keep adding to that a little bit over time. If you have a larger landscape, you would probably want to include kind of different strata within your landscape. So not only perennials, but adding some flowering shrubs and maybe some smaller flowering trees. So you have sort of increased structure to that landscape. And what that does is provide different kind of levels for feeding in your landscape. Some pollinators like feeding at different levels, provides a little shade, a little protection from summer heat or a pop-up thunderstorm or you know, a chilly morning where pollinators might have a little bit of trouble. And that just adds diversity to that landscape and also invites in a lot of natural enemies, which provide natural pest control as well.
We've got a call from Carl in Eagle River. Go right ahead, Carl.
Yes, I had heard once that mosquitoes were the number one pollinator in our backyard. And I'd also like him to address these companies that spray mosquitoes, whether they kill off all our pollinators also.
Okay, thanks, Carl.
Yeah, that's a great question. So yes, some, you know, mosquitoes are very diverse. There are some definitely that do act as pollinators, but of course they're probably most well known as kind of a nuisance insect or a vector of disease. But some of the control measures for them, whether it be the companies that provide fogging in your landscape at home, or down here in Florida, we have aerial application and truck application of mosquito control adelticides to control those nuisance pests. They can certainly have a lot of non-target impacts that will affect many, many other insects. I mean, they're spraying insecticides that are broadly toxic to a wide range of different insects. So, you know, generally, if you want to have a rich garden or landscape full of pollinators, you want to avoid applying broadly insecticides to your landscape. You could apply very selective herbicides or pesticides to a plant that's affected, but never treat your entire landscape.
Because you're going to end up devastating it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have a lot of unintended consequences. You're going to knock out a lot of those good bugs and a lot of the pollinators, which you know, you really want to attract. So it's going the opposite direction of creating a pollinator garden.
Mm-hmm. And some of the pollinators not only look good in our garden, obviously they're fun to watch, but they're really important for us to have a great garden. I mean, not only with flowers, but with the vegetables. Tell us about some of the things that are necessary to have those pollinators for.
Yeah, so you know, if you have a vegetable garden and you're growing tomatoes or peppers or blueberries, those are pollinator, you know, dependent or benefit from insect pollination. So those bumblebees, those smaller pollinators moving through that landscape from one plant to another is going to make sure that you have a robust crop of those vegetables to enjoy. If you have fruit trees in your landscape, you know, many of these are again, pollinator-dependent plants that without these little, you know, helping hand insects, you're not going to have a robust crop of fruit to enjoy. So and many also many of these pollinating insects, wasps or some flies, also provide natural pest control that will, you know, reduce the pest load in your garden, so you won't have to resort to that insecticide or break out the nuclear weapons to control that little pest incursion in your landscape. So, you know, it's not just the pollination service, it's the natural pest control that makes for a really healthy landscape and a healthy vegetable garden or fruit crop.
There you go. So let's talk about, we talked about plants, and then you talked about maybe different stories of plants, different layers. What about hardscape, and what about places for them, little homes? we've talked about bee houses lately, too. Mm-hmm. People are talking about that. So what are some of the things that we can have for the hardscape?
So, yes, you can buy little bee hotels or even make your own. There are a wide range of different blueprints for these online. And basically what they are is artificial nesting boxes for native bees that will provide the resources they need to, you know, develop and partition out a small little nest where they'll lay their eggs and collect pollen for those developing larvae. But probably the best thing we can do in the home landscape is leave some bare ground. Most of the native bees are actually ground nesting. They nest subterraneally in the landscape. So little areas of uncovered bare dirt or partially covered dirt is good. You can also leave brush piles or snags, or don't be so hasty in removing all the dead branches from your perennials from the past year. Many of those hollow stems are also used for bee nests. So they use a variety of different twigs, branches, dead wood, and bare earth for creating those nests as well.
Yeah, we tend to forget about that, especially this time of year when everything kind of looks kind of messy. We want to clean it up. So that's a good comment on that one. Luke in Central Wisconsin has a comment. Go ahead, Luke.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment about the gentleman that called in a couple callers ago about mosquitoes. So people know, I think, overall, or they should, that mosquitoes are the number one killer of people in the world. And I know people want to get rid of them. However, we need to devise some other workness of getting rid of mosquitoes so that they don't hurt all the pollinators. And there has to be a way for that to happen, isn't there, for the caller I'm asking?
Okay. I think what he said was that it was a number one pollinator, not the number one killer, but Jarrett?
But I think the question that he had is, you know, beyond the, you know, are there alternate ways to control mosquitoes? And mm-hmm. and so I would argue that, using pesticides to kill adult mosquitoes is probably the most inefficient way. We want to, you know, reduce the populations of mosquitoes when they're larvae in a body of water. So one of the easiest things is just getting rid of any areas around your house that hold rainwater where these insects can breed. So this might be, trays underneath your plants on your patio that you don't really need, or a bucket that might be sitting out on your porch for some time. Anything that would hold water is a breeding ground for mosquitoes. And you can also buy those mosquito dunks that go into bird baths and, fountains and other bodies of water as well. And that's a much more efficient and targeted way of dealing with mosquito control than trying to use artificial insecticides.
Okay, thank you, Luke. What about water in the garden? Because it is important to provide it for all of those pollinators. What are some good ways to add it without putting in a whole pond or something?
Yeah, so definitely water is essential to many of these organisms, and so I think one of the easiest ways is to have little bird baths in your yard. You could have a small fountain that provides some overspray onto adjacent vegetation. But bees, you know, certainly birds will come to smaller sources of water like this. You know, if you want to get more extravagant, you can create a wetland garden or a rain garden in your landscape, which can also be a great source. You can also provide some regular irrigation that would ensure that there is effective water on the vegetation periodically for these organisms to utilize. But, you know, really just providing a bird bath out in that landscape is going to be, you know, quite useful and equally attractive to many birds, and a great way of enjoying that wildlife that naturally comes into your yard.
I've read that you should have like stones and things that they can perch on in those bird baths.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want a super deep bird bath, so you can provide stones or a piece of wood in there, so birds and other organisms can easily get access to that water. They have a hard time dealing with a deep body of water. So shallow dishes, you know, shallow bird baths with a stone in the middle is great for them as well.
Okay, great. Matt and Alouez is calling. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I've come up with an interesting way to attract birds and pollinators to my yard. And one of the things that I noticed, I have two driveways, and they both have a lot of fallout from the flowers of my maple trees. And what most people would do is blow all that stuff off and stuff, but I sweep it into these heart designs because it's red. And I have noticed that the birds and the insects come to that, and even the squirrels dig through it. And I also did that for like over a year and was able to create soil from that. And I made enough, like two wheelbarrows worth of soil from that at the end of the year.
I love it. Heart shapes. I like your imagination, Matt. That's lovely. That's a great idea, Jarrett, right?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And, you know, he mentions maples. Maples are, you know, an early flowering tree that I think most people don't think of as being a pollinator attracting tree, but it really is. It's a great early season source of pollen, especially for bees in the landscape, and, mm-hmm. you know, provide great shade in the yard, nesting sites for birds. A lot of insects as larvae feed on maple trees as well. So it's, you know, it's a great genus of trees to have in your landscape.
Yeah. And they can be a little messy, so I understand him wanting to get them off his driveway. Penny in Altura, Minnesota, you are next. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Hi there, Jill. So I heard you mentioning the mosquito dunks, which I do use in any kind of water on my property that might be, you know, something I need to have standing. Is there any cost-efficient version of that that's not quite so spendy? Because they do run into a bit of money when you're using them several places all season.
Yeah, that's a great question. Are you talking, I mean, I guess if you're really treating a larger body of water, then there probably are other sources. But for most people, just buying the individual dunks or a pack of six or eight is probably the easiest thing. They do last for some time. But again, you will have to use multiple dunks over time, depending on how quickly they degrade in that that body of water or that small area of water. So I would just, you know, keep exploring what options you have. I don't know off the top of my head if, you know, what larger scale kind of commercial purchases you could make for that, for a larger body of water.
I know that there are things out there that say they work that you can make at home. I guess you could try them and find out. It's hard to say sometimes without doing some tests, but you could try it, Penny. Maybe you should have like one thing that's homemade and one that isn't, and see if it makes a difference. So, and let us know, because I would like to know too, because these things can get expensive after a while. So thank you, Penny. Appreciate that. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. The email, we've had no emails today. This is really, one popped up, talk at WPR.org. Mark in Madison called, but he couldn't stay with us, and he wanted to encourage homeowners to clear out their gutters as an effective strategy for reducing mosquito populations. That's a really good comment.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, that they hold a lot of water, especially if they're holding other debris, leaves, and you know, old flowers in the gutters. So yes, regular cleaning of that, and just going around your landscape and removing any container that can hold water is really the first defense.
Yeah, and we don't tend to think about the gutters because we assume they're draining water like they're supposed to, but that's definitely not always the case. So good thought. Thank you, Mark. We appreciate that. What are some of the specific pollinators that we definitely want to have when we're in our garden? Because there are so many different ones, but some are just star pollinators. So which ones should we really try to bring in?
Well, I think our native bees are, you know, really they perform the heavy lifting of the pollinator world, because again, bees are probably the most efficient, and we have a lot of really amazing native bees that come in a variety of different colors and, you know, are really quite fun to watch. And, you know, they're generalist pollinators for the most part, so they will be attracted to a wide range of different flowers, and they're very, you know, very smart little insects. They go to the flowers that they know give the best food reward. So they're not going to spend a lot of time at plants that aren't giving them the highest quality nectar and pollen. And it's hard to argue against the monarch as being kind of the icon of pollinator gardening, right? And monarchs are under threat. They are declining across most of North America, and they planting milkweeds in your yard as the sole larval host for monarchs and seeing these big orange and black butterflies, you know, really, for most people, that is, they're the star of the landscape. And they're great if you have kids, too, because these big, plump, white, yellow, and black striped caterpillars are a great way of getting your children involved in pollinator gardening and just exploring nature in your own backyard. It's hard to argue against really any of these guys because they're all important and all interesting in their own right. But I really encourage people, again, just to get out and spend some time in your landscape and just watch what comes in and look at the cool shapes and colors and behaviors of these insects. And I think most people will be amazed at the treasure trove of what they actually see in their own yard.
Sometimes we're just so busy, we don't take time to just sit there for a while and watch what we see. Is it a good idea to maybe go to an arboretum or even just a field area and just see what the plants are that are growing there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you don't, you know, have any experience with pollinator garden or native plant gardening, you know, you can easily start at a local botanical garden and get an idea not only of what plants you might see as being really attractive to pollinators, but kind of how to group plants together. You know, this might be based on the form or the texture of the plant or color palette that you like, but it's a great way of getting ideas about how to design your own landscape as well. And you can go to, you know, many nurseries as well. They provide many have, you know, staff that can really provide some good insight. You can also go to your local extension office, a great place for information, lots of resources online as well. So, you know, lots of places to get good ideas, but what you don't want to do probably is just go to a local nursery and just buy one of everything you see, because that may not work the best. I think a strategy going in beforehand is probably good. And, you know, nowadays where we have so much information right at our fingertips on a smartphone, you can go, you can identify that plant, you can understand what are the light conditions, what are the soil conditions, you know, is it a plant that requires a lot of moisture? Because again, you don't want to put a moisture-loving plant into a dry yard and it's not going to perform well. You're going to be sorely disappointed, and those pollinators are also going to be disappointed.
It's just because you want that particular pollinator doesn't mean that the plants they need are going to grow in your garden, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Our guest today is Jarrett Daniels. He's an associate professor of entomology at the University of Florida and author of the book Native Plant Gardening for Bees, Birds, and Butterflies of the Upper Midwest. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or, of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us again on Monday. Bassam Shakashiri is back to reflect on AI in the classroom, science and elections, Earth Day. And then the weather guys are in to talk about all the volatile weather that we've been having lately. But right now we are talking about gardening for pollinators with Jarrett Daniels, author of the book Native Plant Gardening for Birds, Bees, and Butterflies in the Upper Midwest. So, Jarrett, do you have, I know you're down in Florida, but do you have a favorite butterfly that you like to bring into your gardening area?
Well, that's a great question. So I'm kind of privy to a lot of the swallowtail butterflies. It's hard to argue against kind of the large black and yellow tiger swallowtail. It's probably one of my favorites. You know, during my time up in Wisconsin, that was a very common butterfly. And when you see them, you know, clustered on a blossom, I mean, they're just so bright and showy and large. It's hard to argue against that.
They are gorgeous, aren't they? The bigger ones. Although, even the little ones here, we have the, what's the little blue one called? Real pale.
So we have Eastern Tail Blue up by you. There's Spring Azures. There's a bunch of different small blue butterflies.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember the name. It's definitely endangered.
Carner Blue.
Carner Blue. Thank you. I knew it was a K.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw that one the other day. And it is so tiny and when it's closed, you can't really tell it's blue. So I can see how people don't recognize it. But when it opens up those beautiful wings, it's like, oh, it takes your breath away. It's so gorgeous. So you really have to look for them sometimes to appreciate them. So we've got Jim in Kenosha County with a question. Go ahead.
Yes, what happened to all the insects? When I was a kid around here, you used to splatter your windshield up in the summer and get in your house and get in everywhere. And it seems like, it's dramatic loss of insects. And then if you have time, I got one more quick experience.
Okay, you want to answer the windshield question first? Jared,
yeah, so that's a common story. I mean, certainly, you know, I've observed that in my lifetime. I see less insects or less numbers of insects and some less diversity from when I was a child, right? And this is a common, story for loss of biodiversity across the globe. You know, many insects are really facing an uphill battle. We worked and published a recent paper showing about a little over one quarter of all North American insects are under increased risk of extinction due to threats like urbanization, changing landscapes, increased agriculture, climate change, and the list goes on and on, overuse of insecticides. So they're facing an uphill battle from lots and lots of threats. And that's why, you know, looking at your home landscape is so important, because we can create a little bit of that habitat and those resources right at home. And if you do it and your neighbor does it, we can recoup some of that lost habitat. It'll never replace wild areas, but it can certainly help many of these species and, you know, really help all of us in the process, right? Through our health, getting out there, working in the garden, increasing our property value, you know, just a lot of enjoyment.
And what was your story, Jim?
Oh, I have a wonderful experience. When I lived across the border in Lake County, Illinois, on Crooked Lake, 2 years in a row, two summers, I had this bloom of dragonflies that ate every single mosquito on that lake. And I mean, it was wonderful. I wish we could harness it somehow. They weren't those gorgeous ones. They're kind of plain brown. But as soon as they got the ones out of the air, they would dive bomb the bushes. And I mean, no mosquitoes 2 years in a row. How can we make that happen again? And I'll pick the answer off the air.
Thanks, Jim. So do you think, Jarrett?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one. I mean, so many dragonflies are migratory, and so they certainly, kind of have boom and bust years as well. And I've certainly seen, times of the year where they're incredibly abundant, and they are, incredibly efficient aerial hunters. And dragonflies are a favorite prey of theirs, certainly.
Yes, and if you've ever seen that happen, it's something that's so memorable. Yeah, for sure. So thanks for sharing that with us. Bill in Oregon emailed to say that since buying his house, he spent 18 years converting a quarter acre of turf grass into a native pollinator garden. He has many varieties of mint, mandarda, goldenrod, silphium, helenium, milkweed, salvia, mixed with fruiting shrubs. The native plants nourish everything, including the soil. Hummingbirds went from rare to consistent, and bees, butterflies, and moths are a constant part of his landscape. So there's a success story right there.
Definitely. It's wonderful to hear.
Yeah. 18 years is a long time. Very patient. John in Superior has a question or comment. Go right ahead, John.
Well, basically, it's an observation, I guess, when you're talking about having a habitat that helps certain species. And I have, with the encouragement of a relative of mine who works at the main U in Minneapolis on bees and trying to improve their longevity and all that. And she said, well, don't do your lawn, and just let things grow. And, well, I did, and the whole place just with daisies, the park you could see. And of course, all sorts of butterflies came. Not as many monarchs as I used to see. But then if you leave that, and rather than mow it down, I let it go through a cycle where those daisies actually get kind of hard and brown in the center. And then another type of small butterfly comes and feeds on that. They're very small. They're like a mini monarch. And so it was interesting to see the cycle go through it. Even if it looks ugly, it seems to purpose for certain species, as well as this bush that grows alongside my house. It's ugly as can be till these flowers come in the spring or summer. Then certain types of insects go to that. And so I hate to pull it out because I can see it's a source of this particular species. So I guess I'm a softie that way, preserving.
Ugly is in the eye of the beholder, right?
Yeah. And it's a great story because, one of the easiest things we can do in our landscape is potentially either reduce the mowing of our lawn and allow some of the other naturally occurring flowers to come up. And that, it's often pretty diverse. We can also reduce the overall portion of that landscape of turf grass and replace it with wildflowers or extend the planting beds away from your house a little bit more. And that just recoups more of the landscape for providing resources to these really valuable organisms.
Definitely. Anne in Brookfield emailed to say that she believes bee hotels require regular cleaning to prevent the bees getting sick from parasites, fungi, and other diseases. Have you found that to be true?
Yes, that's absolutely true. So they should be cleaned at least on an annual basis. You could also replace them entirely on an annual basis, but that is very true that if you don't clean them regularly or don't replace them, that it can provide some unintended consequences to our native bees. And so, but oftentimes, like I said, you can build your own. It's very inexpensive, and then just replace the nesting material regularly.
Great, thank you, Anne. Andy in Appleton, go right ahead.
I'm pretty touched to the stories of love and care that goes into land development, and it reminded me of a joke I wanted to share.
Okay.
A priest walks up to a man's door and rings the doorbell, and the owner answers the door, and he says, Mr. God has really blessed you with a beautiful, wonderful garden. And the homeowner says, Aye, he has, Father, but you should have seen this place when he had it all to himself.
Oh, I love it. Thank you, Auntie.
That's good.
That's really good. Thank you. Francis emailed to say that they attract birds by putting a bird bath on the ground so it doesn't attract hawks. Francis leaves deeper water sources as a nursery for mosquitoes, and when they reach frisky adolescence, they use the nursery to water nearby plants.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. What would the mosquitoes... I'm not quite sure why he uses the mosquitoes.
I'm not quite sure either. But yeah. I mean, as long as it's working for them, that's awesome.
It's great for him. Great for him. But I use this. I do the same thing. I keep mine on the ground, and then it's used for all kinds of different critters too. So, but you got to keep refilling it all the time for some reason.
Definitely, I know. Yes.
Okay, so if we had talked earlier about if you just want to add an area to an existing a garden. But what if you want to start from scratch? You've got nothing. So what's our first step to establishing a pollinator garden?
I think the first step is really coming up with a planting plan, deciding how big you want that landscape and what you think is manageable, because obviously prepping the site, buying the plants, maintaining the plants, there's cost to that. And you don't want to go too big too quickly if you're not sure that's really what you want to do long term. So start small, come up with a planting plan, do your homework, go to a nursery, look at plants, decide what you might want to include, either by, color palette or size, and then understand how big those plants are actually going to be at maturity. Because people go to the nursery, they see a 1 gallon plant and they take it back and, it could get 8 feet tall and they're not really aware of that. So, again, do your homework about what that plant requires and make sure that you select a pallet of plants that's going to work in your area. Look at it, in the morning, evening and night. Does it receive full sun? Is it a moist site? Is it a dry site? And then really plant accordingly. A good garden always starts with a foundational plan and knowing what you're getting yourself into.
It's kind of like painting your room. All the prep is the important part, right?
It is. It is.
All right. So any last words of wisdom before we have to say goodbye to you?
Well, I just would say that, the nice thing about pollinator gardening and wildlife gardening is that everybody can do it. And it's now more than ever so important to recapture a little bit of that natural world to help these really valuable organisms. So whether you live on 20 acres, you have a small patio garden, it doesn't matter. You can have a small or large landscape. All of it's important. And most importantly, getting out there and just observing and enjoying the natural world. That's really what we need most of all, just paying attention and getting excited about all these amazing organisms that we often take for granted.
Mm-hmm. One last call or email. Someone wanted to know about the health of the monarchs this year. I mean, I had heard that they're doing a little bit better this year.
They are. This was an up year for the monarchs, but they still have a long way to go. That's why, providing those resources in your landscape for those, we want to reverse that decline of monarchs, and everybody can help in that process, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a preferred milkweed plant that you suggest?
Oh boy! So there's several species that will work well in Wisconsin. I particularly like Asclepias incarnata, swamp milkweed. I just think it's a really beautiful plant, and it's actually pretty flexible in the landscape. It has that name. It does like a little bit of regular moisture, but it works well in a container garden. It can actually tolerate slightly drier soils with some regular irrigation. I just think it's a really handsome plant.
Okay, good to know. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Jarrett. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Jarrett Daniels is an associate professor of entomology at the University of Florida and is the author of the book Native Plant Gardening for Birds, Bees, and Butterflies in the Upper Midwest. If you're interested in this, I really suggest you check it out. I am Jill Nadeau, executive producer of The Larry Mueller Show. I want to thank the team, producers Clara Neipert and Joel Pattenut, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and of course, Larry Mueller. Have a wonderful weekend.